This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hey listeners, this is Dan, the producer of Useful Idiots, and before we get into the show, we just have a quick editor's note. In this episode, our guest John Kiriakou states that Matthew Cole gave a classified name to Guantanamo Bay defense attorneys, and that the FBI was able to identify Kiriakou as the source through a connection back to Cole. Matthew Cole categorically denies all of these allegations and further denies that he helped or provided any information to the FBI. Matthew Cole also denies other characterizations by Kiriakou of the events, and we have edited the segment to better reflect what's on the record about this case. That's it. Let's get into the show.
Welcome to Useful Idiots. I am Matt Taibbi.
I'm Katie Halper.
And a lot of things happened last week.
A lot of things did happen last week.
And we'll get to like two of them.
Yeah, at least. Yeah.
So we have an interesting show. We're going to have former CIA officer John Kiriakou on. A controversial figure, former whistleblower, is going to talk to us about a bunch of things. His story is kind of relevant to a few things that are going on in the news lately, so it's going to be interesting to talk to him about that.
Yeah.
Also, some stuff going on with people that we know.
Yeah, Max Blumenthal.
Max Blumenthal, reporter. I think it's on us to sort of raise awareness about this.
It's on us.
Yeah. Because I don't see, more reporters should be nervous about what happened.
Yeah, and, right. We see. We'll get to that, but it's like the Assange factor, where
right.
There's an ick factor.
Right,
yeah,
right. So no one's rising to his defense, right. And they should, because this is a freaky little incident that happened. So let's get to the four food groups.
Right.
We have only four stories. Republicans suck. Democrats suck. Isn't that terrible? Isn't that weird? And we have a lot. I mean, as always, a lot of Republicans suck. But what do we have for this week?
So today I thought I'd focus on the story about Katie Hill, the California Democratic congresswoman.
Crazy story, yeah.
Yeah, and she's announced that she's going to resign because she did admit to having a relationship with a campaign aide before coming into office, but also she's basically the victim of revenge porn. She has a dick of an ex-husband. He should get her Big Dick Energy of the Week prize, probably. She's a Big Dick Energy bearer.
I'm going to stop you right there.
Yeah.
If you run for Congress, I just think you have to take into account that your entire past is potentially going to revenge porn you. Right?
Revenge porn by her past. Yeah, but I also don't think it should be grounds for...
No, I don't think so either. I think this whole thing was crazy.
The thing is that this whole thing with the relationship with the aide, the husband says that they were in a throuple.
A throuple.
Yeah, he and the aide and Katie Hill.
Okay.
That's a three-person couple.
A throuple.
Yeah.
So that's like a continuous, it's not like a menage, it's not just
thing. More of a relationship.
So do you go out together? Who picks up the check?
I don't know. Unclear.
Right?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully the husband.
Right.
Because I would like him to suffer as much as possible.
So they were in a throuple.
Yes.
And somebody got cut out?
Oh, maybe the husband. I don't know, honestly. But the husband's very mad. Maybe it's because of that.
Right.
But the reason we know about this is because RedState.org, that heinous right-wing website, and the Daily Mail, which is a heinous, just like apolitical website, from
the British
England.
Daily Mail.
Yeah, the British one.
I have written for the Daily Mail.
You have?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, a long time ago, though.
Well, besides your piece, a heinous...
I mean, I was just that was from Russia. I was just sending them stuff, you know.
Secrets
about the United
States.
Yeah.
So they published these things of photos of her, and she has accused the husband, rightly, I think, of a smear campaign built around cyber exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, you have people at Red State now tweeting, so she resigned.
Right.
Right. And now you have people at Red State who are tweeting about how people should vote for her opponent. So the journalist at Red State who wrote about this said, she tweeted, if you want to help us flip Katie Hill for CA's former seat back to red, please learn about Mike Garcia 2020 and contribute to his campaign. She's an editor at Red State, the person who tweeted this, which is like a little bit, I mean, way to wear your agenda on your sleeve.
Right.
I guess I kind of almost admire it.
I just hate this kind of politics. This is disgusting politics. Like, let's just do whatever we can to get this person out of office, and then we'll put our person in there for whatever disgusting political reason they want to do that.
And I mean, also, she should have stayed. She shouldn't have resigned.
I don't
blame her, though. I kind of blame the party. So this is one of those Republicans suck, but also kind of Dems suck.
Yeah, they should have.
If they had a spine, yeah.
Right.
And also, you almost don't have to deal. You almost don't have to deal with the relationship thing because it's so shrouded in the revenge porn that all they could do, all they needed to do, would be defend her on the revenge porn front, and then that other thing is kind of taken care of.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing you can say is that, you know, technically speaking, when a boss has a relationship with, you know, somebody that they're who's working for him or her,
right,
that it's never just clearly a private matter, right? So you could make that argument, but that's not the argument they made.
Right.
The argument they made is it was just like a tawdry thing, and that you should bow out because it's like ugly or something like that, which I totally disagree with.
Yeah, and this is where we could take a page from Trump, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, be like, just who, like, you know, I mean, not like hate immigrants and Muslims. I mean, take a page from Trump as in like, whatever.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Put it on the list of 9,000 other things I've done wrong. Like, get in line.
It's not comparable at all, you know, and he's, you know, whatever. He has extramarital affairs. And
well, I mean, you're making a joke about that, but that's actually one of the things that people like about Trump.
Right. I know. So why? Yeah. Well, maybe we could get into that area.
Yeah.
The Dems could try to catch up there.
I think people actually should go out of their way to do something.
Me too. They should make it up, even if it's not true.
Right. I did something really obnoxious and I'm going to stay in office no matter what.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for Democrats Suck, we have there was a lot, but the editorial by Rahm Emanuel in the Washington Post, which I think was, first of all, he's just a classically terrible person.
Yeah.
Rahm Emanuel, he's just unlikable.
Didn't he put a dog head on someone's doorstep?
Did he?
A dog or a fish?
Okay.
I'll look into it. Yeah,
we should look into that. So so he writes an editorial for the Washington Post. Someone needs to say it. Medicare for all is a pipe dream, which is just a, you know.
Someone needs to say it? Like, it's never been said
before? It's like it hasn't been said by 10 million people in every major press organ. But there's a couple of annoying things. He says, when it comes to healthcare reform, Democrats need to mind three basic rules. First, experience teaches us that as much as Americans hate the status quo, they're not too excited about change either. So this is the person who was the right-hand man for the change candidate.
Yeah, and
He's basically telling us that, so let's not go overboard with that change thing, because actually, when you get right down to it, Americans don't really want change.
I guess he would know because he worked on that campaign,
I guess,
right?
He would know. And so the other thing about this that's really obnoxious is, and so he goes through all the reasons we shouldn't have Medicare for all, but both he and the Post leave out the fact that, you know, Rahm Emanuel now has gone to work this year with a bank called the Centerview Partners. I think it's a private equity firm, and they advise a series of healthcare companies. There's Auris Health, Array Biopharma, RA Pharmaceuticals. So he has a direct stake in all of this.
Right.
And this is just the classic thing that you see constantly now in the press, where we're not telling you what the other person's affiliations are,
the
right? Like
they
might work for, you know, a think tank like the Atlantic Council. A lot of Atlantic Council people are on TV lately. Nobody's being told about that. But this is just really bad. It's a classic sort of campaign faux pas to do this. And
so stupid.
I know, it's crazy.
Like, at least be like, look, I'm going to repeat the tire talking point.
Right, that you've already heard 50 million times already. But
see, that's the type of thing Democrats should get in trouble for. Not the Katie Hill thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's make people who do that resign. It's disgusting.
Right. Yeah. And this is the thing with the Democratic Party, is that they feign, you know, social concern, or they talk about it a lot, but then they also have, you know, somebody putting a whole bunch of money either into their campaigns or into their personal pocketbook, and that just affects the decision making.
And then
which
the media
the
doesn't reveal it.
Right.
That's
exactly.
The worst part. They don't really enable it. So less lobbying, more thruples.
Right, more thruples.
That's my advice for the
thruples are great. I like that.
This is a pro thruple podcast.
Right. Well, so terrible. We have a kind of a key thing. You want?
Oh yeah. So my Isn't That Terrible is actually about Elijah Cummings, who is a congressman who died earlier this month, and it's nice that Obama spoke at his funeral, and it was actually very moving. And he was only 68 when he died, Elijah Cummings.
Wow.
And he was someone who, like, Trump said really disgusting racist things about because he's from Baltimore.
Right,
and that's the district he represented. But, you know,
that was one of the, was it Shithole City? Or what would he say?
I don't remember.
I forget.
Like rodents or something.
Rodents, right. Yeah. That was a rodent
we'll
thing.
Shithole
is the other thing.
So that, Shithole is the country.
Country, right.
Yeah, he has different geographical systems. But another congressman died, John Conyers. And I feel like he didn't get enough love Cummings got a lot of love, which he deserved. Wasn't crazy about his politics. He was a bit of a Hilarion. Clintonian.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a very nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
I know this because I'm a nerd who watched the Democratic Platform Committee hearings.
You watch that?
Yeah.
Like voluntarily?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jim Zogby's amazing. Ben Jealous, amazing. Nina Turner, great performances. So Cummings was pretty nice, even though he was in this terrible position where he had to oversee this terrible, terrible people like Neera Tanden and I mean, that's enough, but other
like Neera Tanden and Neera Tanden.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like just pretending that they're four things. Like
right.
we all agree that we want health care. It's just that we have different ways to get there, which is no, we don't agree. You
right.
guys don't want universal.
Somebody
the
just
horse
died
window.
On
yeah,
set.
Yeah, someone
that's
just
terrible.
Died on set to show us the importance of health care.
But we're gonna move on.
But we're gonna, yeah, we gotta put, because we're so committed to getting the word out there.
That's right.
So anyway, Elijah Cummings, RIP, and his father was a sharecropper. He has a really interesting bio. But I want to give some love to John Conyers, who was the longest-serving African-American in congressional history. Now, he did die at 90. I feel like this is a maybe, like, isn't that terrible, which is more terrible? We could do a little
right.
calculation, although maybe that's not very, that's a little gauche to do with people dying.
Yeah, I mean,
that's... All right, we don't have to make it that way. But what about if we just make it, isn't that terrible that John Conyers isn't that terrible that Elijah Cummings died and John Conyers died and that John Conyers isn't getting more love?
Yes, okay, that's terrible.
Okay, that's terrible.
Yeah.
So he was a real leftist, by the way. He opposed Vietnam. He opposed the Iraq War, the Persian Gulf. He was not your run-of-the-mill Dem. He fought tirelessly to make Martin Luther King Day a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And not later on. Like, literally, he started the day after he was killed.
Yeah.
That's, like, very industrious. He did then resign in 2017 because he was accused of sexual misconduct, harassment of aides. He denied it, though.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sad because that is kind of, shrouding his, overshadowing his career.
Right. It's casting a pall.
Thank you. That's what I meant. Yeah. And he was really great and very progressive and much more progressive than anyone. He was famous for how he dressed. And he's one of these guys who I think got better looking as the years went on.
Uh-huh. Really?
So, yeah.
There's, like, some stuff coming out in this show.
Why? What else did I say?
I don't know. The throuple.
I'm just trying. Oh, he was called a district dandy.
Dandy?
Yeah. GQ called him one of the district dandies. And he was a lover of the music of John Coltrane. He hosted a jazz program on a Washington radio station in the 1970s. He got Congress to pass a resolution designating jazz as a national American treasure. And he played the cornet in high school.
Excellent. And so basically you're upset that people were mourning Elijah Cummings more than Congress.
I want both. I'm not, you know, it's not a zero-sum game, but yeah, I would like some.
You think there should be like
the ratio
equity
wasn't good.
In mourning.
More equity, mourning.
Right.
Mourning equity, yeah.
All right.
Exactly, yeah.
That's fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird? And again, this is just for you, even though you deny that this is something that really matters to you. Cats are killing otters.
I hate cats.
You hate cats.
And today is National Cat Day, and
is
I was
today?
Upset about that.
Yeah.
That would have been my, isn't that terrible, but I didn't want to seem too cataphobic, more because I'm, as a dog ally, I don't want to make that PR move.
Right.
I need to build more canine allies.
Uh-huh.
But, okay, yeah, tell me about this.
Basically, there's a rash of sea otter deaths in the Pacific, and this is it's turning out to be associated with toxoplasmosis, so that's poop, right? So that's, bobcats are pooping, and cat poop is now getting into the ocean somehow and killing otters, and which is just disgusting and terrible. And I thought that would make you sad, so that's why this isn't.
Thank you.
Yeah. Does it?
I do. I love otters.
You love otters?
Yeah.
Are they the only animals that use tools?
Do they? What do they use?
The things, right? They use rocks to open shellfish. Don't they?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Do they wear little bibs?
No, they don't wear little
bibs.
Oh, that
would be cute.
Yeah,
like when we eat lobster.
Right. So that's cool of them, but they're, you know, cats are killing them. There's just too many cats.
Yeah, I know. I want to get rid of
the
cats.
If this story went the other way, if otters were killing cats.
I'd be very pro-cat aside.
Right?
Yeah, on the part of otters. And
right.
They could use tools on them.
It's just remarkable to me that there's enough cat and bobcat feces to have this phenomenon actually be observably happening, you know?
Yeah, you're right. They're very prolific, I guess, when it comes to bowel movements.
Yeah.
They're so gross, cats. Sorry. Are you
cats
a cat person?
I'm not a dog. I'm a dog person.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Which is why I think it's so funny that you
so to hell with cats and Pot Save America.
Yeah, to hell with both of them. Rate us because you want to give a big F you to Pod Save America.
And cats.
To cats and sharks.
And sharks.
I hate sharks.
Right. And, they should all be thrown into
And Anderson Cooper is a big
shipping container together. Yeah.
Yeah. With mm-hmm. filled with cat feces.
Right. Right. Exactly. With
and sorry, John.
They should
John.
All get toxoplasmosis.
Yeah.
All right. So that's
that was by the way that was from Kale Fisher. He gave us that heads up.
Yeah. I think readers are becoming more helpful. Obviously, we're slacking on the work departments. They're helping bolster us. So that's good.
We're just trying to expand the media democracy.
Right,
trying to democratize the media.
All right, well, thank you to Kale Fisher, and that was the four food groups. Let's move on to the discussion this week.
Before we move on, though, because I always like to back up my attacks on people.
Your unsupported live statements?
Yeah, well, well, they are supported right now. I mean, the shark stuff, that's a deeply held belief that I don't have to justify. They are sociopaths, we all know that.
Uh-huh.
But I referred to some kind of animal head or animal carcass that Rahm Emanuel left. And it's true that he did send an enemy a dead fish with a card that said, "It's been awful working with you."
So is that like a Sleeps with the Fishes thing? Or is that Fish and Visitors Think in 3 days? What is that?
I don't know. But he sent it to veteran Democratic pollster Alan Sechrest.
There's like the theme with the show of politicians killing animals.
Oh, wait, what else? Oh, my God, Klobuchar,
right? And then
you know, Rahm is such a coward, I bet he got it killed. He didn't kill the fish with his own bare hands.
He didn't catch the fish, for
sure. He didn't catch it, yeah.
Right,
yeah. Also, Rahm Emanuel looks just like Christopher Columbus.
That is true.
It's very weird. So, Matt, you had a tweet that went kind of viral.
Yeah, I mean, it was like an offhand thing. You know, I noticed I was watching a CNN clip last Friday, and I just tweeted out something that I thought was interesting, and it got like, I don't know, 20,000 likes, and it was rocketing around right-wing media, which is always a little odd. But so basically, this is an interview that CNN did with James Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, who I incorrectly called the DIA, which is the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. So that's no fun. I made a little error in the tweet.
Don't feel too bad, because it's not like you were involved in droning people.
I haven't graduated to that yet. But Clapper, who was one of the four senior intelligence officials in the Obama administration, he's being asked about the investigation by John Durham into the origins of Russiagate, and he says this very interesting thing at the end.
Okay, so want to play that?
Mm-hmm.
What the then commander-in-chief, the President Obama, told us to do, which was to assemble all the reporting that we could, that we had available to us, and put it in one report that the president could pass on to the Congress and to the next administration, and while we're at it, declassify as much as we possibly could to make it public. And that's what we did. It's kind of disconcerting now to be investigated for, you know, having done our duty and done what we were told to do by the president.
So there were some people who were upset and said, "Oh, you took this quote out of context."
Well, what's the significance of the quote?
So what he says at the end there is it's disconcerting to be investigated for doing our duty, for having done our duty, and for having done what we were asked to do by the President of the United States, right? And my observation was, boy, I bet Barack Obama is going to love that James Clapper is basically saying we're being investigated for something we were told to do by the president, right? And there were some people who were saying this was taken out of context. He's talking about writing a report to Congress and delivering it to the next administration, and he's just talking about investigating Russian interference. And so you're basically implying that Barack Obama ordered him to do something illegal. No, people who heard the quote that way are misinterpreting it, because all that other stuff that he's talking about is window dressing. James Clapper's not being investigated for doing his duty or for preparing a report or for investigating Russian interference. They're being investigated for manipulating the FISA court, for illegal leaking, for improper use of informants. And so when he says it's disconcerting to be investigated for something that we were asked, for having done what we were asked to do by the President of the United States, he's not saying Barack Obama ordered me to do something illegal, but he is saying whatever we're being investigated for falls under the general category of something we were asked to do.
Right.
So he's setting up a future sort of line of argument or a defense. And I'm sure no matter what the truth is, Obama's not going to like that, right? Because it's pulling Obama into a scandal that currently is kind of localized.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was talking about. And for people got all bent out of shape about it and saying that it was taken out of context. But it really isn't when you think about it.
And what are, just so listeners know and viewers know, what are some of Clapper's greatest hits?
Clapper's greatest hits? I mean, so he and Brennan both have a history of both lying to Congress. They were both sort of the senior intelligence officials who were on board with the drone assassination program, right. Warrantless surveillance. There was an episode, this was more Brennan than Clapper, but there was an episode involving monitoring members of Congress who were looking into some of these things, torture. So he's been one of the key sort of war on terror officials, right, who spanned a couple of different administrations. Yeah. But this thing now, you know, he's a central player in what they're looking at. And you're going to hear a bunch of people talking about, you know, whether they're upset or not about the direction of this investigation. There was a lot of stuff that came out last week about this investigation, and a lot of it has to do with, I think, the lawyers of the people who are being investigated complaining to reporters, and they're all saying things along these lines, like, we resent being investigated, right, for something that we were just kind of told to do.
Yeah.
So
make them clap.
Right, yeah. James Clapper, right, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So let's talk about our mutual acquaintance, Max...
Max Blumenthal. Friend of of my show, at least, friend of the Katie Halper show. Mm-hmm. He's been on the show. And Max is someone who gets a lot of hate.
Right.
He's pretty brave, mm-hmm, and he's a really good journalist. The thing about him is people hate him for lots of different reasons, but they smear him because he doesn't get the facts wrong. So you can disagree with his like analysis or his takeaways or what he thinks should be done based on this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But no one can really, and he has a lot of critics, and a lot of people just go after him for like that he's toxic. Anyway, so Max on Friday was, I think, awoken at 9 a.m. by D.C. police officers who threatened to break down his door. And he was hauled into a police van, taken to a D.C. Central Jail, where he was held for 2 days. He was shackled by his hands and ankles for over 5 hours. His request for a phone call was denied by police and corrections officers. So he didn't have access to the outside world.
Right.
And he was told that being accused of simple assault by a Venezuelan opposition member. He says that the charge is totally fabricated. And he claims, quote, "It's clearly part of a campaign of political persecution designed to silence me and the gray zone for a factual journalism exposing the deceptions, corruption, and violence of the far right Venezuelan opposition." The Gray Zone is a really great website of which Max is the founder and editor.
Right.
The arrest warrant was 5 months old.
Right.
So that's sketchy. And as Max says, if the government had at least told me I had a warrant, I could have voluntarily surrendered and appeared at my own arraignment. I have nothing to fear because I'm completely innocent. And what's interesting is that Max actually, he and other people at the Gray Zone, like Anya Parampel and Alex Rubenstein, who contributes to the Gray Zone, they were embedded in the embassy with peaceful activists. And Max, I think, was involved, what they're accusing him of is helping get food into the embassy,
uh-huh,
which they did because these... Now, look, I don't really care what you think about Maduro and Venezuela. The people outside the embassy are bad. They were bad people.
Mm-hmm.
They were abusive. They called people racist slurs. They called them sexist slurs. There's footage of a guy that I think someone got that Max tweeted out where he calls this woman a little bitch. They're really like scum, these people. They're reactionary. Someone else who was arrested, Ben Rubenstein, the brother of journalist Alex Rubenstein, he also was in the nonviolent legal food delivery. He was arrested by Secret Service police officers. He spent 20 hours in jail alongside Jerry Condon. Now, Jerry Condon is president of Veterans for Peace, and he was arrested after being brutalized by Secret Service officers for attempting to toss a cucumber inside an embassy window.
That's probably a first. Has anyone ever been arrested for throwing a cucumber before?
Cucumber assault.
There's a joke in there somewhere.
There's a joke that I cut out, yeah. I don't know what Max did. Maybe he like smashed arepa into someone's face or something.
Yeah, the thing that's troubling to me about this is
he don't like that joke.
What?
My arepa joke. It was a good joke.
Oh, you had in the arepa joke?
Yeah. What I said maybe he smashed someone's face in with an arepa.
Like the cheese thing?
The meal. Yeah, the food. It's a Venezuelan food.
Right.
I just wanted to, yeah.
Uh-huh. You just wanted to show me you could pronounce it.
Oh, no, not that. I do that all the time. But okay. I wanted to...
It's like saying Nicaragua.
Nicaragua, yeah. Venezuela, yeah.
The thing that troubles me about this is that the... Normally, you're not going to have an arrest 5 months after
right.
the fact, especially over something like this, and especially when a member of the press is involved.
Yeah.
Like, the police normally won't go there. It's just too much of a hassle, usually, to dealing with arresting a journalist, unless there's something real there.
And, right, yeah, of course, yeah.
And we're in an environment now where I think... It's becoming more and more acceptable to start putting pressure on members of the press in different ways, whether it's, we're going to talk to John Curiaco today. He was involved. He was one of the people who was sort of charged with violating the Espionage Act for talking to a journalist. Right.
Right.
And so the next step in this progression is going to be leveling charges at reporters you don't like. All
right,
that's just going to be a thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, Max is kind of, he's the kind of person that would be one of the first people who would be a victim of
right.
this kind of thing if that was going to start happening. And
because he's so
well, he doesn't have a whole lot of institutional support.
Yeah, and
he's
really
annoying
hated,
and
yeah.
he's got doesn't have institutional
annoying
support.
Annoying in the best way, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, in all ways.
And he
yeah.
was also, by the way, he was arrested literally hours after the Gray Zone published an article on USAID paying the salaries of Guaido's team as they
right.
lobbied the U.S. government. Guaido was the coup, how would you call it, the opposition's
right.
president of Venezuela.
Right. So if there's even a hint that this was because somebody doesn't like his politics or his reporting or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, why does that happen 5 months later?
So, yeah, and other reporters should just be like, hey, this is terrible. Let's
yeah.
all like let's all make some noise about
yeah.
it and make sure this doesn't happen. Nothing. Because he's not, you know, Max isn't
he's
like
persona non grata.
He's not a member of the team, so let's, you know.
Yeah.
If it was Jim Acosta,
oh my
you
God,
know, like if he had to spend 10 minutes
Jim Acosta
standing next to a vending machine in a police station, he'd, you know, there,
right.
there'd be like, you know, a Nobel committee worried about it. But
yeah.
this is the kind of thing that it's just troubling. I wish there were more people.
Well, it's a bit like
about.
The Assange thing, right? No one
totally.
Will. I mean, who's like rotting away and insane. And I mean,
well, forget about even
Assange's
person. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no.
His personal suffering. That whole
right.
incident is so relevant
right.
to journalists because
right.
they're criminalizing basically the normal communications that we would have.
Yeah, has nothing to do with 2016, his what he's getting in trouble for. It's like forgiving someone a password, right?
Well, it's agreeing to look into trying to get a password. And that's, you know, I think any reporter would tell you that, you know, counseling somebody on how to avoid being detected.
Yeah, when they're a whistleblower.
When they're a whistleblower, like that's something, you know, this is the kind of sort of normal stuff that goes on. Maybe you wouldn't actually get the password for them, but
you would just tell them you would?
And that's only, yeah, you might. Yeah, no. But there's also, that's not the only count in the Assange thing. A lot of it, the other counts are things like receiving national defense
right.
information,
yeah.
which anybody who does reporting on national security, like we see classified or stuff we're not supposed to see all the time, and if that becomes criminalized,
right.
then you can charge any of us at any time,
yeah.
and so that's. But nobody cares because
no.
it's Julian Assange and
Max,
I don't know,
Blumenthal. Also, what I was reading from was an article at the Gray Zone published by Ben Norton, and it's interesting that Kevin Gostola is the only other person who I saw write about this at Shadowproof.
Oh, really?
I mean, I Googled Max Blumenthal Google News, you know, and there was one, this, which was reprinted some places, luckily, thankfully. But yeah, I mean, it's you'd think that this would be a story.
Well, look, maybe,
but
to be fair, yeah, Max has taken shots at a lot of reporters, and,
right.
and maybe they don't like that. I mean, he's taken shots at me in the past, but
you've forgiven him. Look, you're talking about him here.
Yeah, I mean, this is a collective thing we have to worry about.
Yeah, you don't just defend people because you like them.
Right.
I mean,
yeah, no, it's just there's no sort of institutional self. Pride, you know, in the business anymore.
And the same people who hate Max, by the way, will often hate us.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very overt and open about, they're just like, shut him down, Rolling Stone, shut him down.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even pretend to, you know, there's no tolerance whatsoever.
Right.
But right. We're going to have Max on.
We should have him on.
And you guys can have like a rapprochement. You yeah. can like pass, you guys can pass the pillow. I'll mediate it.
Right. Yeah, we'll smoke the peace pipe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, Max, I'm glad you're out of jail. And we're going to follow this story. But again, if we only defended people who agreed with us, that would be a very scary, an even scarier world.
Right.
So listeners may know I mentioned that Max is a friend of the show, of my show, the Katie Halper Show, which I have. It's okay that I'm mentioning it because I always mention useful idiots on my show, so yeah. I think it's okay. And this week I released an interview I did with Chesa Boudin, who is running for the DA's office in San Francisco. Now, there's something called the Katie Halper Show bump. Mm-hmm. It's happened a couple times. And it's happened again because I released the episode yesterday, and right after, Amo Bernie endorsed Chesa Boudin.
Wow.
Coincidence? I don't know. Yeah. I don't think so. Maybe. But
That's like Bermuda Triangle level stuff.
I know.
Right?
You should. Yeah, I'll go through a list. On another episode, I'll have my list of Katie Halper Show bumps. Anytime a guest who went on wins an election, that's the Katie Halper Show bump. When they don't win it, it's a moot. It's kind of irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's that they didn't come on early enough.
Right.
Like Tiffany Caban came on a little late, I think, if she had come on earlier.
Right. That makes sense.
Makes sense, yeah. Right? So Chesa Boudin, it's really fascinating. His parents were in the Weather Underground.
Mm-hmm.
And his parents were convicted of driving a getaway car in a robbery that did kill three men. So it was very tragic, and it wasn't like part of the plan.
Right.
But it's called felony murder, so when you're committing another crime and then a murder happens. So the mom was in jail, Kathy Boudin and David Gilbert. The mom was in jail for 22 years. The dad is still in jail and as of now will die in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And he, this kid, Chesa, was a public defender, which makes a lot of sense because he was kind of on the side of the incarcerated.
Right.
But now he's doing that thing that Caban did or tried to do, that Larry Krasner did, which is they go from the public defender's office to run for DA.
Mm.
And very sketchily, the San Francisco DA left a month early to, this was going to be the first open seat election for the DA's office in over 100 years. But the guy, the DA, Gascon, left early to move to L.A. where he's going to be the DA. And the mayor appointed one of the candidates to be interim DA.
Uh-huh.
A move that the ACLU condemned because it's basically like you're tilting the scales, but you're also kind of creating an air of incumbency by putting someone.
Or actual incumbency even.
Anyway, it gives the impression that you're running against someone. But Chase is a decarceral progressive candidate. He's the best if you care about decarceral justice. So, and the interesting thing about decarceral progressive justice is that, and this is a reason it's becoming even more popular, is you don't have to be a touchy-feely kumbaya person. You can, like, not care about criminals and still think that and realize that recidivism rates are better, go down, when you have a less punitive criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, that makes sense. Makes sense, absolutely.
So chesaboudin.com if you want.
You didn't tell me the felony murder part when you told me that when the
oh, you thought that they were just in jail for for like,
I don't know,
for organizing a peaceful protest.
Yeah, I don't know what that was. Yeah, that was, wow, he's still in jail, but you know,
oh yeah, I was moved by that. I was like, wow, Matt, it's true. It is a travesty.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be sentenced to die in jail for driving a car though.
I mean, it's murder.
It's felony murder, which it's you murder. Don't believe in felony murder, do
I
you,
do.
As a charge?
Yeah.
No.
Absolutely.
So if you break a law, if you're giving someone a ride and you have no idea, yeah, but I think that's not just because a friend of the show, Chesa Boudin.
The concept is if you break the law, you should have to take into account all the things that could happen
I'm not prepared to debate this. I'll have to come on to debate it next time.
It's just an age-old legal concept. That when
but it's bad.
You commit a bank robbery, someone gets shot, you're responsible for that.
Well, that is, what's really scary about it, though, is that when you're like, you are picking up someone.
There are lots of stories where
it's really egregious.
Where you have somebody who gets into a car with a bunch of friends, and they go to a bodega, and the friends jump out and rob the place, and somebody gets shot.
Yeah.
Like that's a little different because then you're dealing with was the person fully aware? Were they 100%? Like on board with the whole thing? Did they know what was going to happen?
Yeah.
But you know, if someone goes into,
I do
into
think it's different if you get into a car with someone. The plan is like, okay, we're just going to rob these people. And use,
but if you do it with a gun, then you
maybe
you,
it's to scare them.
What?
It's to scare them. I'll find out. I'm not making light of this. Three men did die, but I don't believe in it, not even because of the Chase Aboudin thing.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so Chase is getting a split endorsement from Useful Idiots. Although you may endorse him anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just not sure.
Murder.
Yeah.
We're gonna have to get this would be a good guess, actually, a constitutional lawyer or somebody to talk about this.
Yeah.
So we have a little bit of time left. Quick thing. So Matt, you wrote a piece.
Over the weekend there was a huge story. It started with Donald Trump tweeting something. Something big is happening. Nobody really knew what was taking place. And then it turns out that we find out that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who's the head of ISIS, was killed in a essentially a giant raid. Like there was a huge American helicopter attack in the Idlib province in Syria, and as he's running away, he gets chased into a tunnel by, I guess, dogs, and blows himself up there. That's the story that's come out. And I should preface this by saying it's very, very common for Americans to announce that they've killed a terror suspect and then have it turn out that didn't happen. But in this case, it appears to have happened. And the entire press landscape went completely crazy. Like within 10 seconds, the only important thing was who was getting credit for it. And this happened on both sides. Trump he gave a long rambling press conference where he said it was like watching a movie and he died like a dog, like a coward, and said it was even bigger than Osama bin Laden being died. I mean, it was ridiculous.
My favorite part is that he praised the beautiful dog, talented dog.
The beautiful, talented, that's
into
so Trump. Right?
It's so Trump, yeah.
Right?
I wonder if he's going to adopt the dog.
What? Yeah,
have him move into the White House.
Oh, my God. Yeah, be his running mate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But then it's sort of equally insane was the reaction in all those kind of like mainstream sort of blue-leaning media. Like the issue of what happened and who this guy was and why this was important and all that, it was instantly not important. The first things that came out were everybody was upset because he didn't inform congressional Democrats, which, like, imagine if that story, if when the bin Laden raid happened and Republicans said he didn't inform us, people would have thought that was nuts. But that was one of the first things that came out. Then there was the Washington Post ran I guess it was technically an obituary, and it says Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, comma, austere religious scholar at helm of Islamic State, comma, dies at 48.
That was the most insane thing I've ever seen this week.
Right, yeah, exactly.
This month. I mean, that was insane.
What editor looked at that and said, I mean,
well done.
Right. A friend of mine was like, did they lift that from the text of Gandhi's death or something like that? Right. I mean,
or from like a fan of al-Baghdadi. Like,
right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it would have fit.
If he had a PR man, that's what they would have done.
Yeah. Like a cleric who died in his sleep or something like that. There's two things. First, you're saying kind of nice things about a guy who's got genocide in his record, crucifixions, amputations, sex slaves. Yeah. Then there's also the sort of passive construction, dies at 48, like, what, of natural causes?
I know, yeah.
Yeah.
Like Cummings and Conyers. No, very different.
And that was crazy. And then they there was a public uproar, and they changed the headline, but they kept that construction in the lead. It's still there. The whole thing about the austere religious scholar with the wireframe glasses, that's still in
what
there.
Is that just because they are so upset about Trump being able to use anything?
This is the whole thing, though, is the only question that matters anymore in American politics is who's getting the win on the day's headlines, right? So the story didn't have any meaning for reporters on either side.
Except for
whether it was good for Trump or bad for Trump.
Trump is going to milk the political benefit of Baghdadi because he needs to, because of impeachment and other problems.
Yeah, Yahoo, that was one of their stories. Trump is going to milk this. The New York Times did. Baghdadi raid was complicated by Trump's plans to withdraw from Syria. There was another one. It happened in spite of Trump, not because of him.
Trump's gloating tone contrasted with the more measured tone of Barack Obama after the bin Laden operation. That's, I guess, that is true.
It's true, but
it's not it shouldn't be the headline, right?
Right, yeah, it should be. I don't know, like on that day, is that a story you do? Then there was the whole thing about some guy who was the photographer for when Obama's thing happened, suggested that the whole thing, that the photo of Trump in the Situation Room was faked because the timestamp suggested that the operation couldn't have been going on when Trump was in the... And then later on, he backtracked. But by then, the cat was out of the bag, and we have more cats in the show.
Oh, I know.
And it was all over media that Trump had staged his photo. Then there were people who were saying it was, quote, more staged than Obama's photo. And there were people who were worried about the fact that the Ethernet cables in the picture weren't connected. So they were like, oh, they weren't really... you know, tuned in
right.
while they're like, who cares? It's a PR photo
right.
of the president. Like, he's not actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
I mean, it's just, I'm actually almost impressed by that Trump is going to milk the political benefit of Baghdadi because he needs to because of impeachment and other problems. Because that's the type of thing that we would critique the media for focusing on. Like, but they're actually saying that. Like,
right.
our critique is like, look at how the media is only concerned with how Trump will use this politically.
Right.
But you don't usually admit that. Like, they usually pretend that there's something else besides their concern over Trump's using it politically. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're doing it while they're criticizing it. Like, if you're worried about the guy getting play out of this, just
yeah.
don't cover it, you know, or
right,
ignore
or if everything
it.
Is seen through the prism of how Trump will use this or not use this. Like, there are things that just happen.
Right.
And also, this makes, again, you've made this point a lot, which is that this just feeds into the idea. Now, Trump would like, vilify the media no matter what, but this feeds into it. It's like, why is this a relevant headline
right.
for this guy being captured? Why does anyone care about... I mean, I've had progressive friends who are, like, upset about Trump's, you know, handling of North Korea because they don't want him to be able to use it during the elections.
Right, but...
Don't we care about war and peace?
Know,
yeah, this
exactly.
is the biggest like I feel like divider. You know, Edward Snowden talks about how it's not left or right, the poles of left or right, but it's north and south, or it's vertical, like between authoritarian and mm-hmm. whatever the opposite is. I feel like the biggest divide now is how anti-war you are. Like, it's just not a thing for lots of people.
Right.
Even people, I think it's the Trump derangement syndrome.
Yeah, no, Trump has superseded almost every other issue for,
right.
for a whole sect of people, and a lot of them are in the media.
Yeah.
You know, Trump is just, he's over-important to
yeah.
them, right? Like,
yeah.
they can't conceive of news stories that
yeah.
where Donald Trump is in the center of their
everything,
universe.
Right, yeah.
So they don't look at institutionally what's
right.
going on. They don't care whether... this is a positive or negative development globally.
Right, exactly.
Like, you know, with the North Korea thing, yeah, you do probably want us to negotiate with North Korea.
Yeah.
Even if it's Trump, like, you know, who knows?
Maybe, well, what's the alternative? You want right. him to be belligerent?
Right,
like,
yeah.
you say he's has dementia, it's Cheeto Mussolini, and you want him to be a tough guy with him and Putin,
right.
the people that you say are evil and can cause, like, a nuclear holocaust?
Right.
What is the end game there?
Yeah, like, when he says he wants to withdraw from, a couple years ago when he started talking about withdrawing from Syria,
yeah.
like, good. Like, you know,
right.
the last thing I want is this guy, you know, anywhere near a military conflict
it makes
with
no
Russia.
Sense. Which is like, I think that I always go back to that because it's like, don't they get how incoherent their position is?
Right.
But it's just because it's so reactive. So whatever Trump does, and it makes, I'm tired of disclaiming or declaiming that I'm not a Trump fan, which I'm not. I really don't like Trump.
Right.
But like, it's not good organizing to just oppose whatever he does because he does it. Because bad people will do the right thing for the wrong reasons, or every now and then for the right reasons, maybe, because the way political things happen. But yeah, just reacting to that is not how you do it. And if you want, I mean, there are a lot of arguments that could be made and should be made. Spencer Ackerman had a great piece on this at the Daily Beast about how we create these people.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we kill these people.
Of course.
It's, you know, that is something that we could focus on, and you could criticize Trump for failing to recognize, because, of course, Trump just vilifies these people. Not that I'm like a fan of this guy's, but he was in Abu Ghraib, they say, and we know how much the U.S. military intervention radicalizes people.
Right. That should have been
yeah.
a big theme.
Right.
Like, is this really that big a deal? Because actually, what this whole episode shows is that we're going to be doing this forever because we
right.
create this
exactly.
these
yeah.
people.
So that's a way the left, or even like blue digital, you know, blue media, could go after Trump and make a good argument, a
right.
coherent argument, and also a moral argument. Which, but of course, they can't really make that argument either because they've been supporting these wars.
Right.
So they're hawkish. But progressives out there who are good people and have a little bit of Trump derangement syndrome, I'm not chastising you. I'm just giving you a tip. You could, if you want to go after Trump, that's what you should be doing.
Yeah.
Right?
And conversely, this kind of behavior it just it redounds to his benefit ultimately, right? If you view everything as being about Trump,
right,
that's good for him.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and this kind of stuff, like, just tell us who al-Baghdadi is.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably objectively, it's not a negative thing for him to have this happen. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Well, so, I mean, it's probably not good either the way he, we'll see what happens. But it's not very good strategy to, it's not surprising, but it's not great for Trump to talk about how he died like a whimpering dog.
Oh, no, that's,
right?
that's terrible. And it's going to perpetuate this whole thing.
Exactly.
And you know, their children died in this
yeah,
episode.
His kids were there,
and
yeah.
so, you know, that's going to be a recruiting
it's
tool.
It's funny how, it's not funny, but it's interesting. And this is another thing you could talk about, but like how he blew himself up. And Trump clearly was upset that, because he's Trump, that like they didn't get to kill him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, they cornered him and he blew himself up. But that's why I think he's going into such detail about this, because he has to make it less about this guy blowing himself
yeah,
up.
Yeah, no, that just shows the sadism
yeah.
of Trump, right?
Like, like insecurity too.
Insecurity,
because
totally.
He's upset that they didn't get to kill him, and that this guy kind of like, you know.
Right.
I'm not like
all those things are true, so what? You
yeah.
know what I mean? Like, Trump is Trump. Just like, you know.
This could have been Isn't That Terrible, because the dog survived,
right?
I mean, look, I don't want, it's terrible because the kids died too.
Right.
That part is terrible. Isn't That Terrible? His kids. But also, my dad told me, he was like, don't worry, the dog's okay.
Anyway. Crazy episode. Yep.
Yeah. Really excited to talk to John
Kiriakou.
Kiriakou. Yasu, mm-hmm. John, when you're about to be watching this. John, by the way, is a CIA analyst.
Yeah, he was in the CIA for 14 years.
Started
off in the Iraq desk, which he was originally told, incidentally, was something, a place that where nothing ever happened.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And
was he at the Iraq desk or the Kuwait desk?
I think it was Iraq/Kuwait.
Oh, okay,
I'm not mistaken. Yeah. We should look that up.
He exposed the Bush-era torture program, became the only official jailed in connection with it. He's the author of Reluctant Spy, My Secret Life in the CIA's War on Terror, and his latest book is Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. And you can find out more about him at johnkiriakou.com or John Kiriakou on Twitter. And that is KIRIAKOU. Just an unofficial bio, I want to give people this info. As an 8-year-old, he was a volunteer on the McGovern campaign, which I will mention.
Because you feel a secret kinship with
right,
him. Because, yeah,
right, as an 8, right. Because I was a DeKalbis person, and he
yeah.
over-politicized. Maybe your kids are under-politicized. Maybe you were under-politicized, Matt.
Maybe that's what it is.
But he also, he was recruited to the CIA by a psychiatrist to convince him to quit his job.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And he ended up being, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he was Saddam's biographer within the intelligence community.
Oh, I didn't
so
know that.
So that was another thing. His star was attached to that.
Yeah, the only person, I can't believe it.
And his story is so weird. We'll get into it, but his story is so odd, because what ended up happening was he was out of the CIA for a while, and reporters started coming after him because they were looking for evidence of a torture program, and they thought that he was involved, and he sort of inadvertently sort of confirms some things
and that
ends up like sort of sucking him into this crazy situation where he's prosecuted.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit different from a traditional whistleblower story.
Sets out to do it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. But you know, he didn't back down
right.
from it.
Yeah. Exactly.
It happened,
he spoke out against it, and apparently they were like, they asked him at the CIA if he wanted to be trained in enhanced interrogation, which is what they called the torture stuff, right?
Right. Yeah.
And like everyone else was like, yeah, sure, and he didn't. So without any further ado,
let's talk to John
Kiriakou.
Kiriakou.
Wow, look at that rhyme.
John, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi. This is Katie Halper, and you are John Kiriakou, right?
I am.
We should
it's
have a
pleasure.
Password.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So, really looking forward to speaking to you. There's a couple of things that are in the news that are kind of relevant to your story and your experience that I want to ask about. You might have heard recently Bernie Sanders came out with a statement that he would end the practice of using the Espionage Act for people who talk to journalists, and that seemed directly related to what happened to you. Can you talk a little bit about, just give us the background of what happened with you and how you came to be charged with the Espionage Act, even though that wasn't what you went to prison for?
Yeah, in 2007, I gave a nationally televised interview to Brian Ross, who was then with ABC News. And in that interview, I blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program, and I called waterboarding torture, I said that I thought that it was illegal. The FBI began investigating me within 24 hours, as you might imagine. And they investigated me for a full year, from December of 2007 to December of 2008. And then they issued to my attorneys something called a declination letter, saying that they were declining to prosecute. I thought the case was closed. Actually took my wife out to dinner that night to celebrate.
Wow.
And what I didn't know was that 4 weeks later, when Barack Obama was inaugurated, John Brennan, an old nemesis of mine from the CIA, asked the Justice Department to secretly reopen the case. And I had no idea that for the next 3 years, my emails were being intercepted, my phone calls were being monitored, and that there were teams of FBI agents following me, not 24 hours a day, but sometimes as many as six teams following me. And then finally, in January of 2012, 4 years after I blew the whistle, I was charged with five felonies, including three counts of espionage. So the espionage charges stemmed from the ABC interview and a follow-on interview I gave to the New York Times, to Scott Shane at the New York Times. I hadn't committed espionage, and they knew I hadn't committed espionage. One of the things that we got in discovery was a series of memos between John Brennan and Eric Holder. In the first one, Brennan wrote, "Charge him with espionage." And Holder responded, "My people don't think he committed espionage." And then Brennan wrote back and said, "Charge him anyway and make him defend himself."
So
that's what they did. In the end, I took a plea to a lesser count to violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1981. I'm only the second American who's ever been charged with that as a crime.
And that was I'm sorry to interrupt. That was for identifying, you were speaking to, was it Matthew Cole, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And
yes,
and sort of inadvertently, he prompts you to just to give the background. You were a CIA officer for 14 years. And basically these reporters were after sort of the story about the use of waterboarding and torture, especially with Zubaydah, right? Is that, yeah.
And
Zubaydah. And so he was prompting you for a name and you sort of gave it, basically, right? Is that what happened?
Yeah. What he said was, he told me he was writing a book on the Abu Omar rendition, which is a rendition. It's been covered in the media. It took place in Milan. We snatched this imam and sent him to Egypt to be tortured, and it turned out he was innocent. So he asked me, "Do you know any of these 12 names?" He asked me in an email, and I said, I don't know any of these guys. Kidnapping wasn't my thing at the CIA. I didn't participate in kidnappings. And he sent me a second list of 12 names, and I responded saying, "You obviously know this issue far better than I do. I really don't know any of these people." And then he said, "What about the guy that you mention on page whatever of your first book? I think his name is John." And I said, "Oh, you're talking about John Smith. I don't know whatever happened to him. He's probably retired and living somewhere in Northern Virginia." I confirmed that name to him. And so he took that name. He gave it to the Guantanamo defense attorneys. They put it in a classified motion to the judge, asking for permission to interview John Smith. The judge recognized the name as classified. He turned it over to the FBI. The FBI then traced the information back from the Guantanamo defense attorneys, eventually to Matthew Cole. And then I don't know if Matthew Cole ratted me out to the FBI, or perhaps the FBI went into his emails, although he was a working journalist, and I find that hard to believe. But either way, they traced it back to me, and then I was arrested and charged for it.
Who is Matthew Cole? Is he known as a journalist, or
He's with The Intercept now. He doesn't write much; a couple of pieces a year. I understand that he married money, so he doesn't need this salary. but he was briefly with ABC, briefly independent. He went to NBC for a little while, and now he's with The Intercept.
The really amazing part of your story to me was, The espionage charge was just predicated on the idea that you talked to a reporter, an American reporter, right? Or two American reporters, basically, right?
Correct.
And you weren't the only person that this happened to, right? There were a bunch of people, especially in the Obama years, where they used this trick. And it, it of course has a chilling effect, or doesn't it? It has to. And obviously you had to really worry about the gravity of that charge. I mean, how many years would that have carried if you had been given?
45.
Right.
I was, you know, on the day of my arraignment, the feds offered me 45 years. They said, take a plea, you do 45 years, and you might live to meet your grandchildren. And I remember, like, just being kind of in a fog. I was in a state of shock. And I remember saying, I'm not doing 45 minutes. I didn't do anything wrong. And then a couple of months passed, and they came back with an offer of 10 years. They said, take a plea to espionage, and you do 10 years. Get out in 8.5. And we rejected it. That was on a Monday. They came back on Wednesday with 8 years, and on Friday with 5 years. And my lead attorney was a guy named Plato Kacharis, legendary legal figure in Washington. He said to me, you know, I've been practicing law in Washington for 53 years, and I've never seen them come down in time. If you reject a plea, they always go up in time, right? They offer you 10, you say no, they go to 12, then they go to 15. I said, why are they coming down? And he said, because they have a shit case and they know it's shit and we're going to trial. And so that conversation was in March of 2012. We went all the way up to trial in October of 2012 before we finally negotiated a plea.
Wow. And what was the plea?
The plea was to plead guilty to violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. And I got 30 months in prison. I did 23 months.
And did you have any idea when you spoke out about this torture program, basically, that you would be facing potential jail time?
No. And the reason why I didn't think so was because there are laws in this country that make it illegal to classify a crime.
Right.
So if something is a criminal act, or if it is classified solely because it's embarrassing to the CIA or the intelligence community, it's improperly classified, which in and of itself is a felony. And so I believed then, and I believe now, that the torture program was a crime. And so exposing it was not a criminal act. In my view, it was a patriotic act.
You also, in the book, you talk about how you left the CIA in 2004. You just hadn't been following the news. You assumed that was sort of widely known, right?
Yeah.
And they were coming to you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People came to me all the time. Journalists came to me all the time for background on the torture program. And I really had tuned it out. I stopped focusing on it and went on with my life. And I just didn't think that I was saying anything that was particularly sensitive.
You said that Brennan was a longtime nemesis of yours. What was that about? Like, what are the roots of that?
You know, John was one of these.
But he looks so nice. His face. Just kidding.
Yeah, right. His face.
Face only a mother could love. Probably not even that. Yeah.
You took the words right out of my mouth. So, you know, when I first joined the CIA, John was a GS-15. He was the deputy director of the Arab-Israeli Analysis Group, right? No big deal. Not terribly busy. And there's kind of a famous story inside the CIA. He went to his boss, a woman named Martha Kessler. Martha was the director of that Arab-Israeli intelligence or analysis group. Martha was legendary because she was a published author, which is unusual for a CIA officer, a sitting CIA officer. She wrote this book called Syria, Fragile Mosaic of Power, that we all had to read because it was the definitive work on Syria at the time. So she didn't like John, and John was imposed on her. And John went to her and said, Martha, I think I'm ready to be promoted to the senior intelligence service, and I want your blessing. And she said, not only will you never be promoted to the senior intelligence service, I don't even want you working for me anymore. And she fired him.
Wow.
Now, when you're fired at the CIA, you're not actually literally fired. You have 6 weeks to walk the halls and find another job. And if you find another job, you're good. If you don't find another job, then they escort you to your car and tell you never to come back. Well, this happened the week before Christmas, 1996. And there are no jobs open the week before Christmas. The normal turnover is in the summer. So John started walking the halls, and finally he went to the PDB staff, the president's daily brief, and said that he really, really needed a job. And so they had an opening, and they gave him a job doing the PDB briefing every day for the lowest ranking official entitled to a PDB briefing. And that was the National Security Council's Director of Intelligence Programs, who at the time happened to be George Tenet. Mm. Wow. They immediately hit it off. They're both like nasty, cigar smoking, filthy mouthed, cheating on their wives. They're just awful, both of them. So wouldn't you know, a couple of months later, George gets promoted and he becomes the deputy director of the CIA. He brings John back to the CIA with him, and he makes John the deputy director of the Office of Near Eastern and South Asian Analysis, Martha Kessler's boss.
Oh,
wow.
Poor Martha.
And the first thing he does is he calls her in and he says, "Now you're fired." And so Martha packed up her stuff and walked out, and none of us ever saw her again. George took good care of John because they were friends. John had never served overseas before, but George made him the station chief in Riyadh, right, with direct access to the king, for example. And then when he came back from Riyadh, he made him the executive director of the CIA, the third ranking official in the CIA. John was in over his head intellectually, but he was a terrific political knife fighter. And, you know, that was just never me. I was kind of the substantive nerdy guy. I ended up transitioning from analysis to operations and found that I had a knack recruiting people, right? Your job is to recruit spies to steal secrets for you. I had a knack for it. I have a facility for foreign languages. So John and I were on two completely different tracks at the CIA. He was all politics.
I see. So we'll get back to John in a bit, but there's a couple other things that are in the news that I really want to ask you about. Actually, so recently there was a furor about Hillary Clinton and talking essentially about Tulsi Gabbard. Yeah. There's controversy about the word asset.
Yes.
And you were in the CIA. What does the word asset mean?
The word asset has a very specific meaning in the CIA and the broader intelligence community. Asset means that you are being paid to provide either classified information or access to someone who has classified information. In 9 times out of 10, 90% of the time, you know that you are being paid by the CIA or by an intelligence service, and you are providing that service for cash. So and Hillary Clinton knows this.
Right.
Right? Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. She had a PDB briefing every day. She knew all about the terminology. So, man, when I heard that word come out of her mouth, I thought to myself, blood's going to be spilled over this. You can't just accuse someone of being a paid agent of a Russian intelligence service and not expect for there to be fallout.
But they kind of fell back we're not saying the person's a spy. Like, you know, it's an unwitting.
Yeah, they actually almost mean useful idiot. Like,
right, yeah,
that's
exactly.
Which is the name of our show. But they're pretending that asset means unintentional.
Yes. Yes. That was some fancy footwork to cover up a major boner that she had made.
Right.
I agree with you. What she meant was useful idiot, something that I've been accused of being as well. I think that just doesn't fly.
Right.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think was a story where you have some expertise and are able to talk about is sort of this notion of what is a whistleblower, what isn't a whistleblower. You and I have spoken about this before. When this Ukraine story broke, there was suddenly all this stuff in the news about, we have to protect whistleblowers. They occupy such an important role in society. And that just struck my ear so strangely, since that suddenly like a newfound revelation on the part of the press. What did you think when you started seeing the word whistleblower bandied about? And this person isn't necessarily not a whistleblower, but it just, it was odd to me. I wondered what you thought.
Well, first I want to say how much I enjoyed that article that you wrote in Rolling Stone. I got more mileage out of that article than I think I have out of any other article the last 5 years that has mentioned me. In fact, it was your article, Matt, that got me onto the Tucker Carlson show that night.
Wow.
And I repeated to Tucker what I had told you. And then sure enough, an hour later, Donald Trump tweeted it. I was shocked.
Right.
I've never been tweeted by Donald Trump before. But yeah,
I was a little shocked too. Yeah.
I was shocked.
Yeah.
I'll repeat for your viewers what you and I talked about that day. There's a legal definition of whistleblowing. It's bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. Motivation is irrelevant, right, to be covered by the law. So with that said, my initial knee-jerk reaction was, oh, there's a CIA whistleblower, and he's blowing the whistle on what he believes to be waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality at the White House. But then I read the complaint, and the complaint just didn't add up. The law says that if a whistleblower comes across this information, he has to report it to his immediate supervisor, and then he and the supervisor go to the inspector general. The inspector general does an investigation and then goes to the oversight committee. We know that that's not what happened in this case. What happened was he went to his supervisor, the supervisor went to the IG, that's all fine and good, but then the IG went to the general counsel. The general counsel got the lawyers together. They went to the CIA leadership, then back to the IG, and then the IG went to the DNI IG, the Director of National Intelligence, and then to the Justice Department. So the system just did not work the way it was supposed to work. And then when you read this report, this is not written in the CIA's writing style. We know that the so-called whistleblower is an analyst. I was an analyst the first 7 years of my career. When you're hired as an analyst, you go to the farm, the CIA's training facility down south, and for 6 months, they beat into your head the CIA's writing style so that when you're writing for the PDB or you're writing a paper for the secretary of whatever, no matter who's writing it, it looks exactly the same, right? The product has to be consistent. This was not written in the CIA's writing style. This was written in a legal writing style, which tells me that whatever information the whistleblower had or thought he had, it was morphed into something completely different by a team of attorneys and by the CIA leadership. And so I don't think this is a whistleblower. I think maybe he started out as a whistleblower, but I think the whole process was hijacked by the CIA's leadership and the CIA's attorneys.
Right. And, you know, Do you think that there was more than one person? I mean, it was very odd reading the complaint. Like, it even specifically references the idea that it was that the information came in conversations with multiple colleagues. It seems like a normal whistleblower wouldn't be able to share what was going on if you're at work. That's part of why you blow the whistle, isn't it? I mean, I thought that was an odd detail, you know.
That's right. And presidential conversations like this are compartmentalized. So even if the whistleblower had access to the transcript or to the actual conversation, he would be forbidden from sharing it with his colleagues because the colleagues aren't cleared for it. They don't have a need to know. And so that bothered me, too. You know, we know from The New York Times and we know from Mark Zaid, and we can talk about Mark Zaid in a minute, who's the attorney representing the whistleblower, that there were two whistleblowers. Mark Zaid apparently represents both of them. But there may have been more. And we know that there were these conversations that were taking place, you know, in the hallways with colleagues. So the whole situation is so muddy that I think that we really don't know what happened. But what we've been presented with, this report from the CIA, it just doesn't stand up.
You're a lifelong Democrat. I heard your really great interview with Paul Jay, and you talk about how you joined
that was a long time
ago. It was great. you talk about how you started out your political career at like 8, stuffing envelopes from McGovern.
Yeah, I did.
And like that was me with Dukakis too. So we have that
awesome.
In common. But it's interesting how there's been this political realignment. So you're a lifelong Democrat, and right now Trump may be your only hope for pardoning. You had to go on Tucker Carlson, right? And we talked about this a lot, how like what happens is there's this Democratic mainstream liberal media, and even saying that I sound like a right winger, but like because there's no audience anywhere else, if you want to express what you want to say, you are forced onto someone's show like Tucker Carlson. And yeah, do you get called a Trumpian? Like, can you talk about this experience and how you deal with
it? It's so bizarre to me that anybody would think that I was a Trump supporter. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. Tucker Carlson is 100% right on whistleblower issues. He's always been right on whistleblower issues. He was an early supporter of mine, and I'm deeply indebted for that support. I think he's nuts on immigration and on some other issues. Yeah. But by God, on whistleblowers, he is entirely correct. As crazy as things have gotten, I was invited to Pat Buchanan's Christmas party. If you can imagine such a thing. But you're right. I was a third-generation Democrat. My grandfather had a framed picture of Franklin Roosevelt on the top of the TV that was there as long as he was alive. And I left the Democratic Party in 2012 only because of what the Obama administration did to me. I've come to believe that so many Democrats are so conservative in that war-loving neoliberal way.
Exactly.
That I just can't anymore.
It's almost neoconish in some ways. It's not even just neoliberal, right? Because they actually support the war agenda. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't find much of a difference between the neocons and the neoliberals. They, at the end of the day, they support the same thing. You know, wars for oil wherever we might find them. And so, I left the Democratic Party. I would love to go on CNN and talk about these issues, but I'm not invited.
Right.
I'd love to go on MSNBC, and on rare occasions I'm invited to MSNBC, but I have problems with MSNBC. I did the Ari Melber show a couple of weeks ago, and he called and said, hey, we're going to have Dan Ellsberg, and Dan's a good friend of mine. I said, yeah, I'd love to be on with Dan. And so I went on. Dan had already taped his segment, so I went in wearing my suit, freshly shaven, which I'm not now, I apologize.
That's okay. All right. You like the authentic look.
And I go on, and he introduces me as former CIA leaker and convicted felon John Kiriakou. And I said to him, can I swear on this show?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
I said, motherfucker, is that what this is? Is this a setup? And I went to take off my microphone. And he says, no, wait, sorry, what happened? What's wrong? I said, you're going to introduce me as a convicted felon? That's what this is about? I'm happy to talk about what I did and the fact that I have zero remorse for what I did. But if you're going to try to undercut my credibility from your opening statement, I'm not playing games with you. And so we redid the whole thing.
And leaker, not whistleblower also, right?
And leaker, not whistleblower. And I'll tell you what, it took my lawyers a year to get CNN and MSNBC to stop calling me CIA leaker John Kiriakou and to start calling me CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou. CNN did it first. MSNBC didn't do it until after I was in prison. And then even now, well, I've turned down three requests to do the Rachel Maddow show because she insists on referring to me as John Kiriakou, who styles himself a whistleblower.
Oh, my God.
Styles.
Yeah, so I don't need to do these interviews. I don't gain anything from these interviews. So why would I subject myself to harassment like this just so they can get their digs in? It's just not worth it to me. I'm not doing it anymore. And I'll tell you the truth, I just can't watch MSNBC anymore.
Neither can we. I mean, for comedic value, I do. And or if I want to hate tweet them. Yeah.
And they weren't terribly, it turned out in the end, terribly interested in your point of view on the whistleblower story anyway, right?
No.
They thought you were going to be like, yeah, rah-rah, right? But you were...
That's right.
You weren't even saying negative things. You were just saying, we just have to kind of wait and see, right?
That was the funny thing about the whole interview. The substance of the interview was him asking me 9 ways from Sunday to endorse what the CIA whistleblower was saying. And I kept saying, but I don't think this is a whistleblower.
Right.
You know, there really is such a thing as a deep state. You don't have to call it the deep state.
Right.
You don't have to be conspiratorial about it. You can just call it, like I call it, the federal bureaucracy.
Right? Yeah.
And at the CIA, we have this thing, this leadership level called the Senior Intelligence Service, SIS.
Mm-hmm.
And people who have been or who are SIS have been at the CIA for 25 years and 30 years and 35 years. And they know that they can outwait presidents. They can outwait this president. Presidents come and go, and they don't. They're there forever. So if you don't like Jimmy Carter, which they didn't, or Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, you just ignore the guy. And you wait for him to go away after 4 years or 8 years.
Right.
that's what the deep state is to me.
Right.
I like that, federal bureaucracy.
That'll be easier. Yeah,
no, that's another thing they use, the conspiracy theorist or the Trumpian.
Right.
To discredit people.
Yeah, and they kind of lean into the word, to the term deep state, in order to discredit it.
Yeah.
Right. They bring it up as many times as they can.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. So you wrote a book that I just finished reading this weekend, Doing Time Like a Spy, and we were talking about this off air. I don't know why. Apparently there's some news on this front, but this should be a movie.
Yeah.
So the premise of this book, it's all true. You're set to do your 30 months for the crime that you talked about. And you think you're going to go to minimum security work camp in Loretto,
yes,
Pennsylvania, and you show up, and I think probably most people don't realize this, that even if you're recommended to go to minimum security prison, the Bureau of Prisons doesn't have to do that, right?
They
can just sort of decide. So you show up, and you end up in real prison, and basically the book is about how you used your CIA skills to negotiate 2 years of hard time. Mm-hmm. And so talk first about that. What was that first realization like when you realized, oh my God, I'm going to have to do something, you know, be in a real prison for a couple of years or more. And how are you going to navigate that?
You know, when you first go to prison, it's the oddest experience. You're in a state of shock. You can't believe that this is happening to you. And what you do is you literally just drive to the prison or have somebody drive to the prison, and you knock on the door and you say, "Hi, I'm John Kiriakou. I'm here to turn myself in." And they say, "Oh, okay, come on in." They put you through the metal detector and then they process you. It's the most bizarre experience. So as you noted, the judge recommended that I go to the minimum security work camp. Camps are generally attached to a higher level prison across the street, because in the event of a riot, it's the campers that do the cooking, do the laundry, mop the floors, make the prison run. And, you know, there are no bars on the windows, no fences, no locks on the doors. You're on your honor not to abscond. You can come and go as you please. And most people work in town, sweeping floors at the local university or whatever. And so I got there and I turned myself in, and the cop takes me outside and starts walking me around to the back of the actual prison. I said, no, I'm supposed to be at the camp across the street. And he kind of chortled and he said, "Not according to my paperwork, you're not."
Wow, yeah.
And I told myself, take it easy. There's nothing you can do. If you raise a stink, they're going to put you in solitary. So don't say anything. So I didn't. I didn't say anything. And it took me 5 days to get access to a phone. My first call was to my lawyer, and I said, "Hey, they put me in the actual prison with the drug dealers and the mafia dons and the pedophiles. What do I do?
The chomos. Right?
The chomos. Which was a whole other experience.
Oh, child molesters?
Child molesters. Yeah. And he said, "Oh, my God. Well," he said, "we could file a motion, but it'll be 2 years before we get a hearing." He said, "You'll be home by then. I'm sorry, buddy. You're just going to have to tough it out." And so I said to myself, "You have lived in far worse places than Loretto, Pennsylvania. And I've gone nose to nose with men a lot tougher than the clowns that I ended up locked up with or being subordinate to." So I decided I was just going to take these lessons, these life lessons the CIA taught me, and I was going to use them to ensure that I remain safe and at the top of the social heap. And if that meant manipulating people, then I was going to manipulate them.
The book almost reads like a how-to of how to cope in really any environment. But you talk about the four different things that people respond to when you're trying to manipulate them to, I guess you're trying to recruit basically spies and people,
yes,
informants. So there's revenge, greed, ideology, and excitement, right?
And yes.
Can you talk about what's an example of how to get somebody to, for instance, steal something out of a CO's office or clips or something like that? Like, how do you use those techniques to get somebody on your side?
Let me preface this by saying that when I wrote the book, I asked Oliver Stone if he would write a blurb for me. I've known Oliver for a long time. He's a good guy. I consider us to be friends. He said, sure, I'll write a blurb. You notice that no blurb from Oliver appears on this book. So I sent it to him, and, you know, we were coming up to deadline. So I called him and I said, hey, Oliver, I really need that blurb. Can you get it to me? And he kind of exhales. He said, all right, listen, I read this book. I think you come across as a total asshole. And I don't think I want my name associated with it.
Can you pass me the book, actually?
Yeah.
So to give you an example of manipulating somebody to get something I need, you mentioned clips, right? Or, you know, these binder clips, these metal clips.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah.
Right? Well, you're not allowed to have those in prison. They're considered to be contraband. But every once in a while you'll see one because somebody stole one out of the warden's office. Well, what you do is you identify the guy who mops the floor in the warden's office. I also needed highlighters, which are also considered contraband. And so you get close to this guy who mops the floor, and you try to learn what's important to him. One of the things I learned in prison is everybody's innocent and everybody's appealing his case, right?
Right.
Even though they're all actually guilty and appealing their cases.
Right.
So you talk about how you were wronged by the justice system, and I bet you were wrong too. I bet they're trying to screw you so you can't appeal your case. You know what those bastards did to me? They took all my binders. I wish I could get back at them, you know? And the warden was talking smack about you the other day. I overheard him in the hall. And then you let him say, hey, you know what? They have binders in the warden's office. I've seen them. Like, it's his idea.
Right, yeah, right.
Say, I sure could use some of those binders. And, you know, we should get back at that bastard. And next thing you know, there are some binders laying on your pillow when you get back after lunch.
Right. And you've got a friend for the duration, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You better not go back to jail.
No.
Because people are going to know about this book.
Yeah, they're going to see
gonna
it coming.
They'll be smart about your,
I'm surprised it's not banned in jail.
Yeah.
I'm almost offended that it's not.
Yeah, I know. It should be, yeah.
This whole thing happening now with Ukraine and these sort of dueling investigations that are dominating Washington right now. There's the Durham investigation on the one hand of the origins of Russiagate, and all of your former colleagues are sort of heavily talking about that. And then there's the Ukraine situation with the whistleblower and impeachment and all that. How do you see all this playing out? What do you think is actually going on here? I mean, it's a very complicated tableau.
It is complicated. I think Donald Trump probably did commit impeachable acts. I think that in public speeches, he has expressed willingness to commit other impeachable acts, like on Sunday when he said he wanted to take Iraq's oil, or when he said that he wanted to bring back waterboarding and a hell of a lot worse. I think those are impeachable acts. Mm-hmm. I think that the Democrats, on the other hand, may be going about this whole thing the wrong way. I know that the rules were imposed by the Republican majority when they controlled the House, but that doesn't mean that closed sessions are the right thing to do. And so I think that it's to the benefit of the American people to have literally all of the information out there. I think that we deserve the information so that we can make our own judgments. But I think Donald Trump probably has put himself in a corner that he's not going to be able to get out of.
You were an investigator for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Is it normal? Like, the thing, obviously, there's very often closed hearings, the things that go on in the SCIF, and the controlled...
Right.
What does that stand for? I don't even remember.
Secure, compartmentalized information.
Facility, maybe? Yeah.
Facility,
yeah. I guess the question is there anything that's odd about having an impeachment hearing out of the Intelligence Committee?
Yeah. See, this is a big difference from the impeachment hearings of the Clinton administration and the Nixon administration. In those cases, there were joint committees. They were specifically impeachment committees, select committees. That's not the case now. Now this is being handled by the Intelligence Committee, which, you know, by its very nature is going to be secret. And they're going to have a lot of these hearings in the SCIF behind closed doors with no access to journalists. I think that that's a disservice to the American people. You know, we all remember things like, or we maybe we don't remember them. Maybe we've seen video clips of Howard Baker asking a witness in the Watergate hearings, what did the president know and when did he know it? Well, we deserve to hear the answers to those questions. So, yeah, I think that there should be a joint committee. If the joint committee, if the Republicans don't want to have their members serve in the joint committee, at the very least, there should be a select committee that meets in open session.
Just a few more questions. I'll ask you at once, and then you can figure out which ones you want to answer. First one is, did you join the Republican Party, or did you just leave the Democratic Party?
No.
What happened to your pension? Did any Democrats defend you? And then, this is kind of a longer one, but Matt talks about, in a piece he wrote, about how people think that Donald Trump is, like, the worst thing that there is out there. And that there's actually worse things that involves the intelligence community or the federal,
federal bureaucracy. I guess I was just really saying that they're potentially more dangerous
yes,
than Trump is.
Which is why a coup isn't a good idea, for instance. So you, as someone who's been in the CIA, can you offer any insight into that? Do you agree with that?
And you don't have to.
I thought that you would know about what that would look like.
Sure. I'm happy to answer all those questions. Okay. Number one, no, I'm not a Republican.
Okay,
I will never be a Republican. I can't be a Republican.
Okay.
I could see myself maybe, perhaps someday being a Democrat again. But in the meantime, I consider myself to be part of what's called the libertarian left. And I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah.
My pension. As part of my conviction, the federal government confiscated my pension. I had $770,000 saved in that pension, 20 years of proud federal government service, and the only person who ever came to my defense was John McCain. John McCain sponsored an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act to reinstate my pension. It was taken out in conference committee, which we kind of expected, and he intended to readdress it. And then he got sick, and then he died. And so I'm back at square one.
Did they take, was that civil asset forfeiture? How did they take, I mean, or did they just cancel it? How did they do that?
Yeah, it was, it's a cancel part of the culture. Civil asset forfeiture program.
Wow.
And again, I was the only person that had ever happened to. My attorneys now believe that that was unconstitutional. And there's something called a writ of quorum nobis that we may pursue. I don't know. We'll see. If I don't get the only reason I want a presidential pardon is to get the pension back. If I don't get the pension back, I'm going to have to work till the day I die. And so I'm kind of stuck.
Right.
Your third question. Yeah, I think there are things and people that are a lot worse than Donald Trump. You know, it's funny. Even a broken clock is right twice a day. Right. Let's say Donald Trump is impeached. And let's say that somehow the Senate comes around and he's removed. That makes President Pence.
Right.
And that scares the daylights out of me, because Pence is a true believer in so many things that so many of us have fought against all these years. I don't trust Pence in national security. I don't trust him in domestic policy and domestic security. So, yeah, I think there are things that are a lot worse than Donald Trump out there.
Yeah.
All right. John, thank you so much for coming. I really
appreciate
it.
And no one's been punished, right? Except for you. None of the torturers were punished, right?
Literally none. The torturers, the people who conceived of the torture, who implemented the torture, who destroyed the tapes showing the torture, who wrote the legal positions advocating torture, nobody. I'm the only one.
And nobody's is defending you now. As whistleblowers are becoming apparently an exalted class, you're still not included in that.
Well, sometimes, yeah.
No,
sometimes
I mean by the people who are the Rachel Maddows. I mean, us you are, but that's what I meant. Sorry, the people who are now talking about it for the first time is what I mean. They're not retroactively putting you into it.
Yeah, that's why we have to keep up the fight. You know, it's funny, we national security whistleblowers, there aren't many of us. And so we have kind of this club, we're all friends. We have dinner together. We go to events together and give speeches together. And it's become kind of a tightly knit group. But that's a shame.
And a lot of you aren't available, right? I mean, you're in jail or you're in Russia or what have you. Yeah.
You're exactly right.
Gets in the way.
John, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Take care now.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, so that was really interesting.
Yeah, that was great.
I don't have a lot of CIA friends. Do you have a lot of CIA? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Like again. Former CIA friends?
Yeah, or any CIA
Could
friends.
I tell you? I'd have to kill you, right?
Maybe you are.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Someone actually once told me I should join the State Department.
Really?
I was like, uh-huh, okay, yeah. Wish me luck on that one.
Sure, yeah.
I just want to clarify that I wasn't like face-shaming John Brennan. I mean his scowl. He just looks so angry.
He does have
a
scowl.
Like, yeah. I mean, he's not... Yeah, I'm not going to judge his face.
I don't think it was his face that they were hiring when they made him an MSNBC contributor.
Yeah, he looks so, Oh, Clapper, too. Clapper looks like a little troll. You'd almost like him if he were good.
Yeah,
he'd be a
Clapper
cute little
looks,
elf.
It's something like that Industrial Light and Magic would make, you know, for something like, I don't know, a movie like Willow or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Oh, yeah. He is like a little
like
Willow
grows
guy.
Out of the ground or something. Yeah, he's a very scary looking dude, actually.
But if he were good, he'd be a cute, like, good creature.
Yeah, he'd be like...
Like a Yoda. Oh, like kind of looks like Yoda.
He does have a little Yoda thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas...
But Yoda is cute.
I know, but I'm saying if Clapper were good... We'd find him cute in a Yoda way.
Yes, now I'm imagining Frank Oz's hand up of Clapper's back.
Oh, yeah. You're not the first person who's imagined that. That's a thing. Just kidding.
All right, excellent. So
that was
interesting. And I think it's worth talking to him just because suddenly we're all having to become experts in this like world that none of us knows anything about, right? Because these intelligence terms are becoming...
Right.
The impeachment's being run out of the Intel Committee. None of us... really knew how that committee works or any of these terms or anything. So people like him are becoming more of a resource.
Yeah. And it also is really scary. I mean, it's like it's something that I feel like joins the whole show together, including the name of our show, is that if you are critical in a way that ever lines up with Trump, ever lines up with Putin or RT, they just use that against you.
Right.
And it's really infuriating. And it's like you constantly kind of have to check what you're saying or how you're saying it.
Right.
And even when he said how he got on Tucker Carlson and thanks to your tweet, and I'm sure you're thinking like, great.
Yeah, exactly.
But
that's going to be viral.
It's not your fault. Like, it's not, that doesn't make you right wing. The fact that for political reasons, only the right wing is picking it up is a failure of the left and liberals. It's not because you're a right winger.
Well, the whole whistleblower thing was like when that came up, I thought to myself was, where was all this when all these other whistleblowers were coming out?
Chelsea Manning, Snowden, Kiriakou.
And I thought that was kind of more of a progressive take, but you know, whatever. Now it's all been kind of flipped. So.
Yeah. I mean, as Glenn Greenwald said about Snowden, if he had come out during the Bush administration instead of the Obama one, MSNBC would have a big statue of him in front of
he'd have a show.
He'd have a show.
Right.
Yeah.
And we'd hate him.
Yeah. Well, I feel like he's but I feel like he wouldn't last that long.
No. Right. That's
you know,
probably,
he'd be like,
true.
I'm not going to say these things. I refuse to.
Yeah.
That's my impersonation of him. I can't really impersonate him.
Yeah,
we
no, no.
Get him
he's,
on the
he's
show.
Not. He's not really hammy enough for TV.
No, I like him though.
Yeah. Well, thanks for tuning in to Useful Idiots, and we'll see you next
review
week.
Us on iTunes.
Yeah,
bump
because
us up,
because Pod Save America is terrible.
The Pod Save Americanists win.
Right.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.